Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang. We are just one day away from Krishna Janmashtami, and we do hope that you have caught up on all the Krishna Janmashtami action that's happening on our YouTube channel, especially on the Radio Sai site. A lot of videos being released, ashtakams, bhajans, and tutors, and also the Thursday Divine Darshan, which is about the installation of the Krishna idol at Vrindavan, Bangalore. So a lot of Krishna consciousness in the air, if I can call that, and it will all culminate tomorrow with a beautiful grand procession of all the animals in Puttaparthi coming to Prashanthaniliam Mandir for Darshan, and we will be reliving the days when Swami was physically present feeding all these birds and animals. And of course, we'll be reliving those days from the Dwapara Yuga when Lord Krishna danced, conferring joy to all the residents of Vrindavana, of Gokula. On that note, we will go back to conversations with Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba. I think this is our 35th or 36th episode, and a lot of insights we have gained, a lot of thoughts have got provoked, and a lot of solace we have received, and we will continue again this week as well. Last week we had stopped at a very critical point where, Hislop is asking Swami about time, past, present and future, and Swami had given an explanation. We had put this out and we had concluded at that point in time. We will begin from there now. But before we go into that, we offer our most humble pranams at the lotus feet of beloved Bhagwan, and let's welcome Brother Prem also here. Sairam Prem.
Sairam Arvind, and Sairam to all our listeners. And as you were just saying, last week Swami was talking about a very important concept, and we cannot really say that we understood it or we grasped it completely, and I think that's one of the reasons why we stopped it with at a point where we read it out and we said that if there's anything that people can gather, it would be nice, and it would give us also some time to ruminate over that. And the question was about time itself. I think we'll start with probably that one paragraph that we had read out last week and the following one. The question that Hislop had asked then was, what is this present moment? And Swami had explained, God is omnipresent, He is the ever-present. This moment is God. There is only God. Truth is the same in the past, in the present, and it will remain the same in the future. Therefore, the time sequence of past, present, future is just imagination. But I am timeless, beyond time. I look at present, past, future. They are not me. Of course, past, present, and future must be taken into account in your daily affairs. These two aspects of time must be mixed and in operation at the same time. The perception that the time sequence is only imagination, that I am timeless and beyond time, both should be there at the very moment that one is using the time sequence in his daily affairs. That was a passage that we read out last week. Maybe we'll read out what we have for this week too, and then we'll take the discussion forward. Then Hislop goes on to ask, in the terms of unreality of time, how are we to experience past, present and future? And Swami answers, they are unreal, but at the same time, the Atma is real. Hold to that central reality. There need be no confusion. The inward intelligence may harmonize the experience of the relative time and the permanent self. Even now you are hearing and seeing, yet the inward intelligence coordinates the two. Then Hislop asks, at this moment, we seem to be as we are at this moment. When Swami looks at us with His eyes, what is it that Swami sees? And Swami's answer to that is, man has two eyes, he sees only past and present. God has three. God's eyes are spiritual, so He sees in front, behind, above and below. Like the garland pulled over the finger, The finger is the present and it is in touch with past and future. God is the present, he is omnipresent. As Baba looks at people, he sees the past, the present moment and the future, and everywhere in every direction. I think that was the question and answer, and clearly it is about time and what is time from our perspective and from Swami's perspective, right? You know, whenever we ask this question about when you say Swami can see the future, that is a question that we always have. You know, that is in fact the reason why we come to Swami and, you know, can I take this profession up? Can I perform the wedding of my child in this manner? Can I take up this business? Can I study this course? All of that is with the idea that Swami can see the future, and does Swami see us doing that particular thing in the future, or having we having a better future taking this course of action? You know, when we ask that question, there is a hidden acknowledgement that we are making, right? For instance, suppose if I'm talking about the present moment or me starting something new, I'm talking about multiple possibilities being in front of me, right? Either my business can do really well or my business can do averagely, my business could tank. So when I'm talking about the present moment of me starting a business, I'm talking about the future having all of these possibilities. So when I go to Swami and say, Swami, what do you see in the future? I am suggesting that the future is fixed. And Swami can, from his point of view, see the future and tell me that this is what is going to happen in the future, so prepare yourself. Right? So which means the hidden acknowledgement is you're saying that life is predestined, that everything is going linearly. And I mean, that is what happens with probably when you're looking at space, right? When you're, suppose I am standing in the middle of a road. I can't see where the road leads from where I'm standing. But if somebody is standing at an elevated spot, they can see the whole road and they'll see that, okay, this road is, you know, leading to a ditch, or this road is having a fork later. So it's, space can, you know, you can have a better view when you have an elevated look at the same space. But when we talk about looking into the future, we look at time also as a form of space, and we are wondering whether there is a fixed possibility, and somebody who can see past, present and future can see time also like, you know, space. What Swami is saying here is very, very interesting. And I think what Swami is hinting at here is that one statement which he made, the time sequence of past, present, future is just imagination. But I am timeless. Now, when you talk about from Swami's point of view, Swami's, I think the way it is printed in the book also, it is not about Swami telling that I am timeless. Swami is saying, but I am timeless.
The I
or the self is timeless. So from Swami's point of view, it is like saying that when you say that the separateness itself is an illusion, then time is also part of that separateness. It is also part of that Maya. Right? And that is why Swami is repeatedly saying that past, present and future is imaginary. There is nothing in that. The best example I can think of is when you, Swami would often say this, you know, you look at a wave, you look at its form, you look at its size, and you think it's a separate entity, but the fact is the wave was the ocean, is the ocean, and will always be the ocean. If you look at it, that's the past, present, future of the ocean. But when we think that we are the wave, we are talking about, will I become a bigger wave? Will I become a smaller wave? You know, how long will this wave last? Or, you know, will it be broken by... I'm just trying to think of it in the point of view of that individual experience. But from Swami's point of view, when he says, I see the past, present and future, and the truth is the only thing which is there, past, present and future. The truth is you are away, you are the ocean, you were the ocean, and you will be the ocean. So when you look at it from that point of view, Swami is not talking about a spatially elevated viewpoint, but from the viewpoint of a different perspective itself, the perspective of oneness. From the perspective of oneness, there is no past, present and future, and that is why many times when Swami would, you know, give a instruction to somebody, Swami would say that it's all right, you know, you can go ahead and do that. And sometimes Swami will not give too much importance to what you do in the future. As Swami would repeatedly say, and Swami said even in this part, what is important in the is the present. What you're doing right now is most important, because the future could be anything, and it's part of the illusion. The past is gone, the future is an illusion. The present moment is the only thing which is there, because right now you can connect to the fact that you are one with, you know, that I, as Swami would say. So the way the, you know, Swami explains time or Vedanta looks at time is completely different because the perspective is not from that of duality.
And you know, in discourses, Swami would say, Kalaya Namaha, Kala Kalaya Namaha, Kala Titaya Namaha. It's so interesting, this hierarchy, because first when he says Kalaya Namaha, it's almost like saluting time, means giving time its respect, its due. But then Swami says Kala Kalaya Namaha. It's almost like somebody who is in control of time. You know, he is the Kala for the Kala itself. You know, he is the one who decides, who can decide time because he is in control of time. You know, he is in control of the past, present and the future. But then Swami says Kala Titaya Namaha, which means what you were saying right now, that it's a totally different perspective. It's not about controlling time. It's not about being at a higher level and being able to see past, present and future, but seeing it in a totally different way because you are beyond time. You know, time doesn't touch you at all. Just like the number of waves coming, or going by the same analogy, the number of waves coming, the structure of the wave, the nature of the wave, the size of the wave, it does nothing to change the ocean. You know, you might have a tsunami coming. At the same time, you might have a very placid ocean with not a single wave. Yet the ocean remains the ocean. It is not affected at all. Nothing diminishes it or nothing adds to it. And that's why it would often be, it is often said, Purnamida Purnamadam, Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate. This is full, that is full, and you know, even if you take out the fullness from the full, it still remains full. It looks like a tongue twister, but it's very, very profound. And yes, so Swami says, as Baba looks at people, he sees the past, present moment and the future, and everywhere in every direction. It's just like how the ocean possibly perceives the wave. I mean, it doesn't matter where the wave is, what is the size of the wave, when it is coming. All this come into importance from the perspective possibly of a wave as an individual entity. But for the ocean, it's all just the same.
And in fact, that statement which you read out, I think it's a very profound way. Swami says that everywhere in every direction, you know, that's what I was referring to as the multiple possibilities from the present moment. When you talk about the future, you're talking about multiple possible events that could happen from this moment on. So when Swami says, I see you as the conglomeration of all those possibilities, Swami would say that that is what is called the concept of Hiranyagarbha, which is supposed to be that seed form where all the possibilities are contained in that seed. So you don't see that seed as the possibilities, but see the potential of the possibilities in that seed. As you know, along with all those names, Kala Kalaya Nama, Kala Titaya Nama, another word Swami would use is Kala Garbhaya Nama. God is the one in whose womb time rests. So Swami is saying that when I look at you as that. I don't look at you as somebody who is subjective to time, but I look at you as somebody who is beyond all of that time. In fact, I think that is another point which is going to come where Swami talks about the 16 kalas. But what Swami is referring to is in the consistency with which Swami's message is always referring to you as you are the ultimate. Right? Swami only, and the other point which Swami is making, once you are in that state, you very easily harmonize this thing. It doesn't mean that you completely forget the idea of, yes, the same Swami who says that there is something that you have to do in the morning, there's something that you have to do in the afternoon, there's something else you have to do it in the Sandhya moment. The same Swami says that. And what Swami is telling here is it becomes very easy to harmonize your role within the time and beyond the time once you're able to establish yourself as somebody who is beyond time. Right? And I think that's one of the statements that Swami makes, that you are in a position where you're able to harmonize these two roles that you have to play.
I think at this point in time, there is a visitor who is seated there and possibly who decides to...
Must have been waiting to ask this question.
Yes, waiting to ask this question, and at the same time also possibly to break the, atmosphere of profundity that's existing there, because as we said, it's quite difficult even as I am speaking about it, there is a partial understanding and there's a partial confusion, and I'm sure these are all seeds that get into us, and they will all sprout when the right time comes in the right manner. But it's important that the planting of the seed goes on. So this visitor then says, I look at Swami's photograph on my desk at home in my country, and I receive Swami's instructions. he ordered me to come to India to this conference. And Swami says, you think of Sai and get some feeling. The visitor continues, I look at Swami's photograph and send him questions and problems from other people. And I receive his orders and instructions for those people. Is that all right? Immediately Swami says, no, it is not all right. For yourself you may ask, but you should not think of placing yourself between a devotee and Sai. That's a wrong idea. So time and again, you know, Swami has emphasized this of a direct connect between the devotee and the Lord. Don't get any intermediary in between. When you go to the temple, go there for the Lord. Don't go there to, you know, butter or win the affection of the priest who is over there. The priest is just performing his duty there. You know, we often, there are quotations or proverbs in every Indian language which refers to the fact that people go to the temple and try to get pally with the priest because they think that if you are pally with the priest, you get favors from the Lord. So it is there in my mother tongue, Kannada, and I'm sure an equivalent exists in Tamil, in Telugu, in every language. That is what Swami is saying here, that no, you go and develop a direct connect. Many times, you know, the priest gets the aarti plate and people put money in that. Sometimes, not in the really huge temples, but in some of the smaller temples, it is the source of livelihood for the priest. So, he's also looking expectantly, and sometimes you just feel the pressure, the peer pressure, that I too must put some money in that plate there, because, you know, whatever, the priest will be happy means then he may chant the mantra in the presence of the idol with more feeling and I will get more benefit.
I think some priests do not even hide the feeling. know, sometimes in some of the temples I've heard them saying, you've come to a temple, you're not giving dakshina to the priest, do you want to lose all the punyam? I mean, I've heard him saying
put
that.
Put fear factor into you.
Right, you know, that's the best way to extricate money.
So that part Swami is very clear and he's saying that I don't want any of those. Nothing of that is needed. You develop a direct connection. And Swami is saying here, you know, that you should not do it for other people. No need to bring problems and questions of other people and put forth. You do it for yourself. At the same time, I think, Prem, I also want to clarify that this doesn't mean that Swami is discouraging us from praying for others. You pray for others. There's a difference between being an intermediary and spontaneously praying for someone, you know. You just see somebody and your heart melts and you pray for them. That's one thing. But you going out and advertising, you know, saying that Swami regularly comes to my home, you know, there is manifestation of vibhuti happening. Yes, it is happening. It is a sign of His grace. And last week, I think we had discussed where Swami had said, it was me, I was showering my grace there, but then they became money-minded, so I have stopped going there now. You know, Swami is telling this to Hislop. So, there is a shower of grace. We accept it, we are happy for it, but that doesn't mean that that becomes an exclusive center for us to receive God's grace. If not for going there, we won't receive Swami's grace. All this is nonsense. You know, I think we are violating what Swami is saying here when we say, I want to go and keep an invitation card or, you know, a greeting card or a letter about my problem in that person's home because Swami stays there and reads. You know, unconsciously, I am proclaiming to the world that Swami does not exist with me in my heart. Swami does not exist in my home. Or if I'm writing a letter here, he can't read it. He needs it there. You know, these are things Swami says, no. At the same time, you're spontaneously feeling. You get karuna, you get compassion, you get sympathy, you get empathy, whatever. And you say a prayer for the other being. That's great. That is wonderful. But don't go and say that I'm here available. Whoever wants to pray, you give the prayer to me, it reaches Swami faster or better. I think that is what Swami is dead against. And I really hope that we take this message to heart, learn it sincerely. Because it's a most liberating kind of thought and feeling. Just to know that Swami is as dear and near to me as He is to anybody else. How beautiful it is. How all inclusive it is. We want to give up this all inclusivity and go for some exclusivity which is highly restrictive, which is highly, you know, it puts a lot of constraints, it costs us a lot in energy, time and money, and we are just inflicting this upon ourselves. I think this conversation makes it very clear. Swami says, it is not right. Swami is not saying that it's okay, fine, it's not compulsory, it's fine, it's not good, not bad, not like that. He is categorically stating that it is not right. For yourself, you may ask, but you should not think of placing yourself between a devotee and Sai. I think it's also an important message for, you know, people possibly like us who are, you know, either through our words or through our writings or through whatever videos, we are trying to spread Swami's message. We are speaking Swami's message. Even as we do that also, I think we should keep in mind that the idea is to share the glory and love of Swami so that everybody celebrates and gets a connect with Swami. No way it should be intended, or should it result in, consciously or unconsciously, in the person or becoming a substitute for the direct connect with Swami. The direct connect with Swami is so, so vital. But again, as I said, at the same time, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't spontaneously pray. In fact, we should spontaneously pray not just for one or two beings, but for the whole universe. That's the reason I think Swami has given us the prayer, Samasta Loka Sukhino Bhavantu, to be done at the end of every session, every prayer session.
In fact, you know, the wordings with which Swami is saying this, it might be a little dissecting it a little too much, but I think it would not be wrong to, from the understanding point of view, because as you were saying, because Swami is saying here, it is not all right, you know, because the question that that person was asking is, you know, I receive orders and instruction for others. And Swami is saying it is not all right. For yourself, you may ask. You know, when you talk about praying for others, when you talk about praying Samasta Loka Sukhino Bhavantu, or when there is somebody who is suffering in front of your eyes and you're praying for them, and Swami would always remind you that that spontaneous prayer is actually not for that person. You are suffering seeing that person suffer, and it's a cry from your own heart, you know, so that suffering can be solved. That's why I'm saying I might be actually literally dissecting what Swami is saying here, but I think the idea is there. As long as you're doing it because you are pained and you are sympathizing with that, probably it is your prayer still. It is not you praying for somebody else. But the idea of you becoming a medium towards, you know, for others to come and reach out to, and I think that is what Swami is saying, that is a very wrong idea. Don't try to place yourself between others and Swami. And the interesting thing is, you know, I think many of the listeners and devotees might not realize that this was happening even in Swami's physical presence. In fact, it would happen more in Swami's physical presence, because, you know, I would always think of it, when you talk of Swami's physical presence, it is one person with 24 hours. You know, when you talk about time and Swami being timeless, when you talk about the physical Swami had only 24 hours, like each one of us. And we were about few thousands of devotees vying for those 24 hours. So which means that time was very precious and not all of us had it. And we were all wanting to have the benefit of knowing Swami, as, you know, what Hislop was talking about. Swami, you know the future. Swami, you know what is right for us. And we all wanted that benefit of knowing Swami, but we did not have the time of Swami like everybody else. And I think that is what made all of us vulnerable, because I know a lot of people who are staying in Prashanthi Nilayam, Swami students working in the ashram, but they will go to somebody else who says that, you know, in my house Swami comes and gives replies in the form of letters.
Or even when Swami is physically
there. Even when Swami is physically there. In fact, one of the key persons in the Mudan Ali saga, I mean, let's not go into that. I think we spoke about it enough last week. Mr. Narsimurthy, there's a very famous incident of he trying to ask Swami about a boy who is getting these visitations from Swami and all of that. And Swami kind of rubbished it, and Swami said, no, don't talk about it. Whether or not that person was genuine, it's a different thing. But Swami did not encourage somebody who was so physically close to Swami going into all of that.
I think the brother who was witness to this,
my brother Satyajit,
was narrating this, and he goes on to say that Swami's words were, "Nakem pattindi a padu shariran velladaniki." What you know? What in? I don't get the exact translation, but something like, "Am I mad to go and occupy some body like that?" Okay. And what brother was saying is, even after that happened, then Swami left for darshan. Mr. Narsimurthy comes to him and tells that, you know, whatever Swami may say, but there is definitely something special in that boy. I am sure Swami is going there, you know. Right. And he was saying that I was looking at him like, Swami has just now smashed you and you are continuing to hold on to that.
Right. So, I think most of these people, when I look at it, you know, why do we go to somebody like that when Swami has repeatedly said that I am available to everybody? Even though physically not available when we were with Swami, Swami was always available, just like how he is available to everyone. In fact, one of our volunteers who is from Canada, she was saying that she was brought up as a child, shown Swami's pictures and saying that he is God, you know, brought up with that idea that he is your dearest friend. So she was saying that first time when I came for Swami's darshan, I think she was a teenager then, she felt, oh my God, why is Swami so distant? Right? Because physically Swami was much farther away from than the real Swami she had grown up with. Right? So even physically when you find that distance, you become vulnerable to this. Because for all of us, at some point it comes to a situation where our problem or solution to what we are going through becomes bigger than this physical, this inner connection with Swami. So we are ready to take anybody's help who comes and says that I can connect you with Swami. And I think always we should remember that we are devotees to connect to Swami first. All the other problems are secondary. I think till we are attached to our worldly problems, we will never be able to go beyond that and reach this inner connect. And the other thing is, the people from the other end want to play this role. I think, as Swami was telling a couple of weeks back when we were talking, there is grace sometimes, but that grace turns into ego very quickly when you don't realize that you should not be a person standing in between Swami and his devotees. That again comes from the feeling that, you know, that ego can even come as compassion, as that beautiful incident we have narrated a few times of Professor Nanjundia trying to go and talk on behalf of some students. Apparently Swami was not talking to some of the students who were otherwise very close to Swami, and when he spoke to one of them, he said, "Sir, what is the point of living? We want to, you know, we might as well end this life. Swami is not talking to us." And he was so moved by that. He said, "Oh my God, these boys have so much love for Swami." And he went and told Swami, "Swami, this is what these boys are telling. Why don't you speak to them?" And two, three things which Swami told him is, first thing he asked, "Nanjundaya, do you have more compassion than me?" Right? And it suddenly struck him that it's a stupid thought, that here I am thinking that I am being moved by their plight, but Swami is not being moved, so let me go and talk on behalf of them. So I think that is one of the things that you should never forget, that we are not more compassionate than Swami, we are not more just, and we are not more understanding than Swami. And the other thing that Swami said is, you know, "See, my heart is butter, and butter melts when there is heat. If you find that this butter is not melted, it means there is no heat there. So remember that it is not my fault, it is always the fault of the devotee." So I think these are the things that we forget when we are praying to Swami, when we see somebody in suffering. I mean, there's not to point a finger at anybody. I think all of us have been in this position. Even when we see some disaster happening around, a natural disaster, we say, "Oh, Swami, why is this happening?" For a moment, we forget that He knows what He is doing. You know, it's not that the compassion that we are feeling in the heart, Swami doesn't feel.
Speaking of disasters, I remember listening to a discourse, I think it was in 2001 or 2, when the earthquake had struck the Indian state of Gujarat. Bhuj, yes. And Swami sent truckloads of relief material with a lot of volunteers to go and do seva. And He directed them to go to areas which are inaccessible. And after all the immediate rescue agencies leave, you know, because when there's a calamity, immediately a lot of rescue agencies come there. But long-term rehabilitation takes time. And that is where Swami wanted everyone to get involved in from the Satsai organization. So when that had happened in one of the, I think it was a Dasara discourse maybe, Swami was speaking about it, and Swami said, "People may ask me, instead of sending relief, why couldn't you have prevented the earthquake from happening?" Right. And Swami answered that by saying, "See, that is a law of nature. Law of nature won't be touched. It will be left like that. But having come in the human body, I follow the love of man. So you don't try to change the law of nature, but then try to work on the love of man aspect. What usually happens is, in the name of law of nature, you know, we give up love of man. You know, things like, it must be the karma, that's why it's happening. You know, it might be the karma, but doesn't mean you don't do your bit.
Right.
That is what is in your control as you have come in this human form. So you do it. When we look in the long term, you know, Swami has said many times that Vyashti, Samashti, Srishti and Parameshti, the hierarchy, where Vyashti is individual, who is part of Samashti, which is society, which is part of Srishti, which is nature, which is part of Parameshti, which is God. Somehow we believe that if we do good for God, God does good for us. But if we do bad for God, and if we do bad for God, we better beware. That's why we have the fear of God and all that. But somehow we don't have the same kind of fear of nature or fear of society. And that's possibly because we forget this hierarchy. Swami says, no. The society is as divine as nature, which is as divine as God Himself. or God herself or God. Therefore, remember that in the long run, it's all going to come back. You know, if we look, forget a particular state or a city or a country, or if we look at humanity, if we look at ourselves as part of humanity, as humanity, definitely we have not done so many things right when it comes to society. We have not done so many things right when it comes to nature. And I don't think it's a coincidence that we are seeing a rise in all these kinds of unrest, whether it's at the societal level or at the level of nature. You know, more volatile rains, a lot more floods, a lot more natural disasters, so many happening everywhere. At the same time, even unrest in small areas in society, all this keeps happening. And this, I think, is possibly the karma of humanity as a whole. Humanity as a whole not doing its duty properly. So the best way to remedy that is to start doing our duty. What is our duty? Swami would say hridaya. Hridaya, heart, means that which is filled with compassion. It is meant to shower compassion. So when there is an earthquake, instead of sitting and asking why this came, how could God be so cruel, what could, instead of that, dive into it. Let your heart melt and go. And what is the proof that your heart has melted? You have done something positively about it, you know. Tried to contribute in some way to assuage the pain of the people there or something like that. And that is what Swami said in the discourse there. He said that, let's not speak about law of nature, but instead of that, let's focus on love of man. And that is why I have sent relief. That is why we are doing this. And I would like that everyone engage in seva of some kind, so that, you know, I think this is the way we build up positive karma for humanity as a whole. Each one of us, each little droplet in the ocean, continue to do our duty, you know, towards everything. That is individuals, society, nature, and God.
Right. And I think when prayer is an expression of that kind of a feeling, I think Swami does not disapprove of that. But when you think that me praying to Swami is going to help because I am closer to Swami than the rest, I think that is what Swami is saying is the wrong attitude, where you think that you can come between God and a devotee. So I think with that disclaimer, probably we'll just take a small break. And it's pretty sad that, you know, even when you're talking about disaster, India is facing a really stark situation. I think last time around this time, we had only one state facing that problem. Kerala was under a huge deluge of floods. Today we have so many states. I think probably Andhra Pradesh is the only state which is not as much affected by the others. And fingers crossed, let's hope that that doesn't happen. But so many states. I think
Karnataka, Maharashtra, Gujarat.
Right. We'll probably play out that song which we made last time during the same time when, you know, for the flood as our collective prayer, hoping that people will be safe and will be able to pass through this disaster that we're having. Dear listeners, we'll take a short break. We'll play that song for you. On the other side of it, we'll continue with this conversation that Hislop and the other visitors are having with Swami. Karunya Sagarani Kamala Manoharani Karal Pokum Nyang
Guruvayur Purisha Verillorashrayam Guru Pavana Purisha Guruvayur Purisha Verillorashrayam Guru Pavana Purisha Odiva ಕಣ್ಣ ಕಳಿಯಾಡಿವ ಕಣ್ಣ ಕಳಿಯಾಡಿವ ಕಣ್ಣ ಓಡಿವ ಕಣ್ಣ ಕಳಿಯಾಡಿವ ಕಣ್ಣ ಕಳಿಯಾಡಿವ ಕಣ್ಣ ಕಾಮ್ಯಮಾಯಿ ಕಂಡದೆಲ್ಲ ಕಬಡ ಮಿನ್ನದರಿನ್ಯಡ ಕಣ್ಣು ಕಳಿಯಾಡಿವ ಕಣ್ಣ ಕಳಿಯಾಡಿವ ಕಣ್ಣ ಉಳ್ಳಿಲ್ ವಾಡು
Welcome back, dear listeners. After that beautiful and soulful song, we move on to the next question. Again, a visitor asks Swami, what are the 16 points of the avatar? You know, I think this question comes from knowledge or awareness of the fact that it is said that every avatar has 16 colors or 16 aspects by which it can be recognized. So he's asking, what are the 16 points of the avatar? I have asked and nobody knows. And Swami says, the difference between man and avatar, man experiences the 15 factors, but he is not their master. They go their own ways. As control starts to be gained, man comes closer to the 16th, the all-knowing Paramatma or Supreme Self. The five working organs have to do with talking. I think that is Karmendriyas, have to do with talking, taking, walking, rejecting, which is excretion, and eating. The five sense organs, that is the Jnanendriyas, hearing, touch, sight, taste, and smell. Then the five elements, earth, water, fire, air, space. The 16th factor is the all-knowing Paramatma.
I think it's a very interesting point that Swami is saying here, because whenever you talk about the 16 kalas, which are, as you were saying, the 16 kalas of an avatar, a Purna avatar is somebody who comes with 16 kalas, and Swami would say how Lord Rama was not a Purna avatar. The 16 kalas were distributed amongst the four brothers, and together there were 16 kalas. That is one of the concepts of Indian philosophy, where they talk about 16 kalas, and there you can kind of translate them as 16 powers an avatar comes with. All-knowingness, on the ability to create, the ability to manifest at different places. Those are usually referred to as the 16 kalas. But this is Swami's unique explanation, where he says the 16 kalas are nothing but the five Karmendriyas, the five Jnanendriyas, the Panchabhutas, the body is made of the Panchabhutas. And then Swami would say it's the soul. The 16th one is the soul. And I think elsewhere Swami explains this. He says you all are the embodiment of the 16 kalas, but you do not know that because the Atma has not taken its precedence over all this, or you have not understood. I think Swami is saying
I think that's why Swami says that. Swami starts off the answer by telling, I'll answer it as the difference between man and the avatar.
Right.
And Swami says, man experiences the 15, but is not the master.
Right.
So he...
Swami explains that very beautifully. He says that the avatar, the difference is, he knows that he's the master of all this. He's not any of this, as Swami would say, that man is thinking that he's the body, thinking that he's the senses, thinking that he's the mind. The avatar goes through the entire thing. You know, he also has a body. Yes. I mean, we've seen Swami, we've had the fortune of observing Swami. Swami also has all of these things. Swami also appears to be limited to time, to space, and all of that. But since he is aware of all these, him being the master of all of these things, Swami says the 16 kalas that you talk of as the different powers becomes very natural, because when you are able to establish yourself as the Paramatma. So I think this is actually an explanation which is unique to Swami's discourses compared to what the Bhagavatam says.
And then, going along with the flow, Hislop asks Swami, one sees people breaking coconuts in front of Swami's car as he is departing from Prashanti Nilayam or Vrindavan. What is the significance of this? And Swami says, as long as there is water, meaning worldly desire, in the nut, and as long as the meat clings to the shell, the nut will grow if planted. As the unplanted nut ages, the water disappears, the meat leaves the shell, and the nut will not grow. The nut is chosen as a symbol because of the three eyes, the two physical eyes and the eye of wisdom, unopened. When the nut is broken, it symbolizes breaking the closed heart and asking the Lord to take the contents. This is surrender. Nothing inside can be concealed, and once the nut is broken, it will never grow again. So Swami explains the significance of why we break coconuts. I mean, people coming to Prashanti Nilayam would have seen it happening a lot at the Ganesha gate, where, people offer coconuts. In fact, the grill to the Ganesha temple has been modified and built in such a manner so that it facilitates breaking of coconuts. And right opposite is also kept a bin where the broken coconuts can be put in. These coconuts are taken, dried, and, it is used in the canteens to serve as prasadam. This is the complete cycle. You offer something as naivedyam to the Lord, and it comes back to you as prasadam from the Lord. So while that is the naivedyam prasadam cycle, here what Swami is saying is the coconut is chosen because when we rip off the what do you call that? You know, it has a kind of a tuft. Yeah, a fiber tuft. When we rip that apart on the nut, we will see three eyes. Swami says that the coconut is symbolic of everybody because everybody has three eyes. The two physical eyes and the eye of wisdom which is unopened. And therefore, this coconut symbolizes each one of us. And we say that, you know, we are breaking this Dehabhimanam. We are breaking this body consciousness, this attachment to the world, to the body, and offering all the contents to the Lord. When you do that, you know, there's no more, if I can say, karma or rebirth. Because, you know, many times Swami gives the example saying that the past is a tree, the future is a tree, the present is a seed. The seed connects us to the past and the future because this is a seed that has come from the tree of the past and this is a seed that will grow into the tree of the future. So, in that sense, the coconut is also a seed only. And Swami is saying that if you want to get out of this cycle of birth and death, this punarapi jananam, punarapi maranam, what you need to do is break this dehabhimanam and offer yourself completely to the Lord. Because once you offer yourself, there is no more growing of a sapling or a tree. There is no more. I mean, it is the breaking of the cycle of, you know, if you take it in botanical parlance, it is the cycle of tree, seed, tree and seed. You know, tree giving rise to seed, seed giving rise to tree, tree giving rise to seed. Swami says that seed, if it's offered like this completely, the cycle breaks. And as a prayer to the Lord, you know, whenever we break the coconut, we have to do it with this prayer that, Lord, let me break my dehabhimanam, let me break my body attachment in the same manner in which I'm breaking and shattering this coconut. And, you know, speaking of which, again, I'm reminded Ganesh Chaturthi is again coming very close. What a beautiful time of the year it used to be to watch Swami break those coconuts.
Right.
When the chariots would come with Ganesha before the immersion, on the immersion day, Swami would go and break coconuts in front of each chariot. So sometimes he would shatter the coconut to the floor. At other times he would hold one coconut in one hand to use as a breaking rod and then break coconuts on that one coconut. It was amazing, and I used to wonder at whether it is even humanly possible or is it some divine effect that we are seeing in front, because one coconut in Swami's hand would never break at all. The other coconut would keep breaking into exact halves, and Swami would break about 9-10 coconuts in that manner and make offerings. It might be a technique, but for me, it definitely felt so divine, so beautiful. And there's a lot of footage of Swami doing it, and it's unforgettable to watch it.
Absolutely, that the beauty of those two coconuts. I had always wondered that, you know, with one coconut, we would struggle to break that without, you know, in some way hurting our hand. In some way, because that fiber is there, it'll poke, or, you know, there'll be a crack which will...
The kernel itself may poke.
Huh? Right. But Swami would, in tens and tens, Swami would do that, both during Ganesh Chaturthi and, of course, again during the Ayudha Puja also. Swami would do that.
Correct.
Swami would do that again during Akhanda Bhajan, when the prasadam would be brought. Swami would break a few coconuts. But that symbolism, as Swami is saying here, I think Swami had also given the example of the grain and the husk sometime back. And Swami was saying again, it is that desire being the husk, and if you remove that, you cannot. The grain does not give forth fresh harvest after that, and that being the same with human life, the moment you're able to overcome desire, there is no furthering of this illusion, is what Swami would say.
Going ahead, you know, very interestingly, Swami initiates this conversation and it's recorded in this manner. Swami says, Mr. X is a great scholar with various degrees and a lifetime of sadhana in the Himalayas and elsewhere. To that, Hislop responds, I suppose degrees are okay, but the only scholarship of interest to this individual, meaning himself, is scholarship in Swami's teachings. It is like locating the greatest deposit of gold in the world. Why work on anything else? Swami picks on the word gold and he says, the mention of gold is important. Deposits of gold are not limited to one place in the world. But gold is found only by certain individuals. God is not limited to one place only. He is everywhere. And he may be found at any place by those who are pure of heart. And by that, I mean where there is love in the heart. You know, when Swami speaks of gold, it reminds me how Swami would address us endearingly as Bangaru. Not just us, whether it is Sai Gita or the cows in Gokulam. Whenever Swami wanted to express affection, he would use the term Bangaru. And this term Bangaru or gold was also the subject of many, many student and teacher speeches, whether it's in the hostel or in Swami's presence, because I think there are so many analogies comparing us to gold. You know, one thing of course is gold is one of the noble metals, so it's considered to be unaffected by rust or corrosion or anything like that. The elements don't affect gold. That's why, you know, it is often called as the gold standard. So it would be used in that sense, saying that we have to become like gold, unaffected by all that happens around. Then only would we be true devotees of Swami. One imagery or one metaphor or example that is very vivid in my mind is how it would be said that God is the goldsmith and he subjects the gold to the fires, the hottest of fires and the greatest of pressures. But that is done only to purify the gold. And then how will the goldsmith know that the gold is pure? It is when he looks into the gold and is able to see the image of himself in the gold, he will know that the gold is pure. Meaning that when we truly reflect the image of Swami within us, have we become his Bangaru? So in that sense, you know, people would say when Swami tells you Bangaru, immediately you feel very happy. But remember that there is this process of beating and heating and burning that is going to happen. Be ready for it, to go through crucibles. But at the same time, you should be happy, because you know that though it is beating and heating, it is going to result in making you that pure gold which will reflect divinity.
Yes, I think Professor Kasturi would say that, you know, when Swami calls you Bangaru, you should be a little careful. In fact, he would even say that there are times when Swami would give him an instruction or something and he would wait there. Mm. And he would say, what happened? What are you still waiting? He said, Swami, you have not yet said Bangaru. Right? You did not refer to me that way. In that sense, it's a very beautiful appellation which Swami would use. I recall when Swami had taken all of us to a devotee's house. I think we were about 100 of us. And we were all in that devotee's living room. And Swami was sitting in a beautiful, very regal looking sofa right in the center. And we were all like, you know, trying to see over each other's shoulder. We were all standing. So it was a funny sight. Swami was sitting there, and around Swami was sitting all the devotees belonging to that household. And a few boys were sitting in front, and the rest of us were standing, and we were trying to look at Swami. So this devotee was standing next to Swami, and he was telling, please sit down, boys, please sit down, please sit down. And none of us were listening to him, because we were all looking at Swami. Then Swami, very calmly and sweetly, Swami led, Kurchondi Bangaru, Swami said. You know, the way Swami said it was like so sweet, and immediately everybody, the whole crowd, you know, settled down. The way Swami was like so deliberately and consciously, Swami said, Kurchondi Bangaru, wow. Swami said. Right, and the way Swami would use that. But the usage and what Swami is saying here is very, very important. Swami is saying that it's not that the gold is available only here. Right? When he is saying that, I'm only interested in Swami's message, in Swami's word. What Swami is saying is very beautiful. It's not like the gold is available only in one place. Mm. It is available everywhere. What Swami is saying is, I think, can be explained in this manner. Do not necessarily go after the gold. Try to prune this ability to find gold. Mm. Right? Swami is saying it is about the ability to find the gold. Gold is everywhere, but only few people know the art of finding gold. So instead of focusing on the gold in one spot, can you learn the art of recognizing gold? Then you can find it wherever you are. Yeah, I think that is a very important tip Swami is giving here.
And Hislop, again, you know, in response to that, he says, no doubt gold is in every place, but great treasures of gold are seldom found. It is the same with great springs of water. In Baba, one finds the spring of divine sweetness. I think it's his gratitude and love for Swami that is just pouring forth. And Swami says, waters from springs are often impure. Pure water may be found by digging for it. One person may dig 100 feet and another person may find pure water at 40 feet or even 10 feet. It is the same in spiritual life. The amount of work needed to find the divine sweetness depends on purity of the heart. You know, as I read this, what occurred to me is, you know, when Swami says water from springs are often impure, I suddenly thought, no, Swami, whenever you look at Ganga, all the rivers in India begin from springs and it's supposed to be the purest. But then it is because even in the process of it emerging from the spring, it comes in contact with things external. And that is why Swami says they're often impure, possibly not as impure as, you know, water that we see running in the rivers. But Swami is saying it is not as pure as the water that is found deep within the surface of the earth. In fact, the water table is the water table in a region is what all of us tap into usually to get water for our daily use, because it undergoes so much filtration through the earth and it goes down there. You know, in my understanding, I felt Swami was referring to one being independent rather than dependent on something external to finding God. You know, because that is the context in which it is said. Hislop is saying that in Baba, one finds a spring of divine sweetness. Swami is on one hand accepting the fact that yes, he is a spring of divine sweetness, but he's saying that it would be much better if you can depend on what is within. You dig. Swami is telling, pure water will be found by digging for it. Go deep within, dive within and discover that water within you rather than going for external springs and depending on it. Yes, external spring water is purer than normal water. It is good, possibly. But that should not be what you are dependent on. And I feel, you know, this is what makes Swami divine. You know, any person who is possibly craving for power or influence will not make such sentence, will not make such statements that will, you know, affect his own popularity, or it will result in his fall in the eyes of people. Fall in the sense that, why would I want to tell people that you don't need to depend on me? No, you don't need me. It is within you only. If my objective is to collect devotees and become big, and, you know, it will make sense to say that, yes, I will be there. I will give you. You focus only on me. Forget everything else. No. Swami is saying, good, yes, you can get this, but then you can get this and much more even when you just dig deep within you. I mean, we were speaking about mediums and other things. I feel this is another beautiful differentiating factor. You know, so easily you can see the selflessness that is there in Swami. There is no interest, there is no slightest inkling also that I can use this opportunity to build people's loyalty towards me, or, you know, increase my own popularity or growth in the numbers of people following me. No. Throughout his life, Swami has always kept emphasizing the same thing that, yes, you can worship different gods, you can worship, you know, in discourse also he would say, Rama, Krishna, Govinda, Sai Baba. And when he tells Sai Baba, we just clap because, hey, Swami never talks about himself, he's telling Sai Baba. But in what context would Swami say that? Swami would say that, you can worship all these, but you will realize that you are the same divinity. This kind of continuous harping, I think only the avatar does, only absolute selflessness can do. As Swami would say, love is selflessness, self is lovelessness.
In fact, there was once when Mr. V. Srinivasan, the former All India President, late Mr. V. Srinivasan, was speaking in Swami's presence. And I think it was in Vrindavan when he started saying that, you know, this is the Sai path. The Sai path will take you to the ultimate goal and all of that. And following him, Swami gave a discourse, and very sweetly, you know, Swami said, see, Srinivasan has a lot of love for Swami, and in his love, he said the Sai path. Actually, there's nothing like that, Swami said. Very, very sweetly, Swami, you know, denounced that thing and said, there is nothing like Sai path. See, now God has come in with his name and form. But the path is eternal. It is the path of love. Swami said, that is always there. And if you have love, if you have purity of the heart, and if you have devotion, there is nothing like the Sai path. There is only that one path. I think that is what Swami is emphasizing here, and, you know, what you were saying about making use of that. I think that selfishness is never there in Swami. In fact, Swami would tell this. It's very difficult for us as devotees to kind of reconcile with what Swami is saying. When the initial years of the organization, when Swami would tell them that you should do Nagar Sankirtan, you should start early in the morning, go around the town. And Swami would say that, see, slowly people will also join you, and people will join the Nagar Sankirtan. So Swami would tell them, see, don't carry around a palanquin or a picture of Swami. He said, people might not like me or might not be devoted to this form, but they will always enjoy the idea of going around early in the morning taking God's name. And Swami told them, it seems in the interview, that he doesn't mind if you say Sai here and there. People will not mind that. But a picture might be a little more offensive for them.
Mm.
So Swami would say that no need to take a picture of Swami, just do bhajans and go around. And in fact, in the early 60s, a lot of devotees came to Swami purely through that medium of Nagar Sankirtan. The devotees would, three or four of them would start the Nagar Sankirtan, and eventually it would become a very, very big affair. Every Thursday it would happen. We see that in many of the cities even today. And I think that is what Swami is saying, that the overall, the idea is it leading to purity of the heart? Is it leading for you to, at the same time, there is that balance between, you know, love for Swami, what is being expressed here by Hislop, and the idea of the universality of Swami. I think that balance is what Swami is talking about.
The next question also is very interesting in terms of the answer that Swami gives. So, we'll go to that, and possibly that might be the last question we'll take today. So, Hislop asks, is it only by the strength of one's love for God that he comes in union with God? Or are there other essential factors? And Swami says, the most beneficial thing that can happen to a person is that he should draw God's love to himself. You know, very, very important to note this sentence. Swami is saying, the most beneficial thing that can happen to a person is that he should draw God's love to himself. His love for God is of less importance because it is an imperfect mixture of divine and worldly love. The most important action to gain God's love is righteousness, dharma. Spread out on a flat surface, there may be gold, silver, copper, iron filings, diamonds, rubies, silks and other things of value. But a magnet pays no attention to all the riches. It selects only the iron filings. It is the same with devotees. God does not select on the basis of wealth. He looks at the purity of heart. It's so beautiful how Swami says, it's not important that, you know, how you love God, because your love is going to be tainted with worldly desires, different way. Ensure that God loves you. And the only way to do that is by leading a dharmic life, a life of righteousness.
Right. I think he's made it very, I think that analogy also is so very beautiful. Swami says, you have all the ornaments spread out, but the magnet attracts only the iron. So it is literally, it's the experience that all of us have had. We've seen so many people coming to Swami, and there is no other pattern you can put to it. In fact, even we cannot even go by this idea of purity of the heart, because it is not visible to us.
Correct.
But there is no logic in, you know, whom Swami speaks to. As students, we've seen it. Hundreds of thousands of students whom Swami speaks to, which is the one who gets the attention. Or many, many politicians come to Swami, which is the politician who gets the attention, which is the devotee who gets attention. There is no pattern we can draw to it. We can only clearly say that, you know, when Swami gives this analogy of the magnet pulling out the iron filings, that randomness is something that we've always seen in Swami's action and the way Swami would shower his love.
In fact, you know, when I was reading this answer, I was reminded of a very, very famous poem called Abo Ben Adam, a poem by the poet Leigh Hunt.
Mm-hmm.
It's so beautiful, and it speaks of this only. It speaks of the importance of winning God's love by doing one's duty, by doing one's dharma. You know, it doesn't matter so much as to whether you love God. And I think when Swami is saying here about you loving God, it is like Swami says that you think loving God means doing worship or doing some puja. But Swami is saying that just leading a life of dharma or a righteous life is what is the meaning of loving God. So I just felt that we can read out that entire poem, and the poem goes like this. Abu Ben Adam, may his tribe increase, awoke one night from a deep dream of peace, and saw within the moonlight in his room, making it rich and like a lily in bloom, an angel writing in a book of gold. Exceeding peace had made Ben Adam bold, and to the presence in the room he said, what writest thou? The vision raised its head, and with a look made of all sweet accord, answered the names of those who love the Lord. And is mine one, said Abu. And is mine one, said Abu. Nay, not so, replied the angel. Abu spoke more low, but cheerily still, and said, I pray thee then, write me as one that loves his fellow men. The angel wrote and vanished. The next night, it came again with a great awakening light, and showed the names whom love of God had blessed. And lo, Ben Adam's name led all the rest. You know, it's a very popular story. It's so beautiful in its meaning, and it's highlighting exactly what Swami said. Abu Ben Adam sees an angel writing names of all those who love God.
It's a Chinnakatha which Swami also says, of course, a little differently, a little more clarity, I think, than the poem.
Naturally.
Yes. And Swami would say that, you know, the same thing. He finds an angel writing a list, and he goes to the angel and asks the angel, what are you writing? And the angel says that I'm writing the list of people who love God. And Abu Ben Adam, a great devotee of the Lord, he goes and asks, is my name also part of it? The angel looks at it and says, no, I don't find your name here. And Swami says the next day again, he sees the same angel, and this time making another list. And then Abu Ben Adam goes and asks the angel, what is the list that you're making now? And the angel says, I'm making a list of the people whom God loves. And then Abu Ben Adam asks, is my name in that? And then the angel says, yours is the first. And Swami would say it is because Abu Ben Adam, of course, as a person, he was somebody who was known for the way he cared and loved the people around him. He was a person who used to feed the poor, clothe the, you know, those who needed it. And Swami would say that, see, that is how he had won the love of God. And it's so important that you find your name in the second list rather than the first list.
You know, it goes back to the thing that we mentioned and we have harped repeatedly in multiple satsangs of the same Vyashti, Samashti, Srishti, Parmeshti thing. Many times we think that loving God means offering flowers to a deity or traveling to a certain place and doing certain activities or rituals. But what Swami is saying is that Samashti is also God, society is God, nature is God, and out of concern, love and selflessness, when we do anything towards society and nature, it pleases God. In fact, Swami is saying here that you need not do anything to please that entity called God. You no need to do your rituals, no need to do your worship. You can do it if it is giving you peace of mind and you happiness. For your sake you do it. God doesn't need any of that. I mean, that is the reason why we have so many, you know, beautiful examples, analogies. We also have this shloka which says, phalam patram pushpam toyam. God is happy with a flower, a leaf, water. Swami takes it a step ahead and says, you need not even pluck a flower and give. Just offer your heart to God. Hridaya pushpam you give. You need not even, you know, pluck a leaf. Offer your deha patram, your body itself. You need not get water and offer to the Lord. Offer your tears of joy. That's enough. You know, because Swami is making it very clear that to that entity called God, you don't have to do, because the ultimate objective is to see that divinity everywhere. And when you're doing that, when you're serving the Lord in the poor people or serving the Lord in nature, when you feel for the bee, the bird, you feel for the animal, you feel for, when you feel like that towards everyone, God automatically is receiving. You know, God will possibly tell you that I came hungry and you fed me. I was injured and you dressed me up and healed me. Because that is what it is. If we refuse to see the divinity in all, it's like we are being hypocrites. Swami is saying that God is present in all, but we say, no Swami, if it is you, I am ready to spend whatever money, do whatever for your sake, but I am not ready to do one tiny bit of effort for somebody else, because that is somebody else. So Swami says, as long as this disconnect exists, you will never be able to, you know, get that union with God. Because that is what Hislop is asking. Hislop is asking, is it only by the strength of one's love for God that he can have union with God? Swami is saying, it's not important that you love God as that entity. It's important that you lead a good, noble life, a dharmic life. In fact, this was the advice that Swami gave even to Gopal Indreshwar Sirohi, the grandson of the Rajmata. You know, when it came to the question of his marriage, because he is also Swami's student, he was insisting, you know, he comes from the royal family, and he was insisting that, Swami, I want to marry a girl only if she has faith in you, if she believes in you. At that point in time, he says that Swami advised him that, see, you don't go with that mindset. go with the mindset that you want to marry a good girl, a girl who has a good character. And then Swami said, the goodness in her will automatically get attracted to the godliness in me. And today, you know, if you meet him and talk to him, he will say that my wife is a bigger devotee than me. He definitely says it without an iota of doubt. So what is more important, Swami is saying, is you being good, you being dharmic, you following righteousness. And I think that is the way we become Abu Ben Adam for the Lord.
I think there's another very beautiful story. I don't know whose it is. I'm not able to figure out that. Leo Tolstoy, is it? Cobbler has a dream where Jesus comes and tells him that I'm coming to your home tomorrow for a meal. Mm. It's a very beautiful story. I think it used to be part of our lessons in school. And of course, Swami also, in Swami's college also, we've heard it being narrated and dramatized, where he has this dream where Jesus tells him that tomorrow I'm coming to your home for a meal. Mm. And being a very, very devout man, he's absolutely elated by that. And he prepares a very elaborate meal and he's waiting, you know. And the story goes that first he sees a mother who's very, very starved, who's having a baby, who's not able to feed that baby. Mm. And it's snowing outside. So he calls the baby, the mother and the child inside. He feeds them the soup that he has made for the Lord. And, you know, she's very happy. She's satisfied and she goes. And then he finds another boy who comes, who faints in front of the house, who's starved. And he brings him inside, gives him food. So I think three or four guests like that. Mm. You know, he feeds them and then the food.
Finally, nothing's left for Jesus.
Nothing is left and Jesus also doesn't turn up. And he doesn't realize, you know, how can what God has said has not come true. And I think that night, Jesus again comes in the dream. And then he asks, you know, Lord, you told me that you're coming and you didn't come. And then the Lord says, I did come. And he shows the three forms, you know, in which he had come. And the beautiful summary of that is, they say that the dream concludes by saying that, remember that whoever comes to your door is me. And that's the whole idea of how it is being the moral of that story. And I think that is the final understanding of, as you were saying, it is not that, you know, you have to serve God in a different form, or, you know, you have to worship him in the form. But it is this idea of seeing him in everybody. Finally, I think that's what Swami would say is the final culmination. Later, I think in conversations itself, there is a point where Hislop asks Swami, what is self-realization? Mm. And Swami finally says that when you walk down the road, when you see a person suffering, do you feel the same pain? Then you're self-realized, right? You know, that's what Swami gives as the final understanding of self-realization itself.
It also reminds me of a similar episode that's mentioned in the Shirdi Sai Satcharitra. An episode that happens in Shirdi Baba's life where, not in Shirdi Baba's life, possibly in the life of a devotee of Shirdi Baba, wherein Shirdi Baba has promised him that he'll come home for lunch. I think it has been beautifully depicted even in the movie Shirdi Ke Sai Baba, mm-hmm. which was incidentally divinely directed and produced by Swami himself. Because, you know, it was done through a charitable trust of a devotee, and the movie was screened first in Bhagwan's presence. So in that movie, there is this episode wherein a devotee who has become a devotee, because he has been a critic of Shirdi Baba all the while, and his own life is saved by Shirdi Baba when he is bitten by a snake. So he becomes very grateful and he says, Baba, you must come home and accept my offering. And he has prepared a feast. And on that day, when everybody is waiting for Shirdi Baba to come, an old man walks in and he's very hungry and he's unable to contain his hunger. So he takes the food and starts eating it. And this man gets very upset and, you know, takes this old man and throws him out. And this old man goes away. End of the day, nobody comes and he goes to Baba and says, Baba, I kept waiting for you whole day, you didn't come. And Baba tells him, I came, but you scolded me and threw me out. And then he says, no, Baba, but I just want beggar for his impudence and arrogance, I did that. He said, who was that beggar? Baba asks him, who was that beggar? And then he realizes. And Shirdi Baba tells him that as long as you are not able to see me in everyone, you will never be able to see the true me. And that is the advice he gives. And I think it's the same, what you said also, is the message that is given, that whoever comes, you see them as me. So that is what Swami is telling over here also. It's not important that you depict your love towards the form of God. As long as you do your duty, dharma it's many times Swami has emphasized on the importance of dharma. In fact, Swami says, dharmo rakshati rakshitaha. And when you say dharma, it is not about just talking, but action, doing. That's why Swami is telling you, continue to do. In fact, Swami would say, love in word is truth, love in action is dharma. So you have to have love in action and not love in action. On that note, dear listeners, we will conclude today's afternoon satsang. We will continue possibly on the same conversations next week
as well. Maybe next week we'll do something different, because it also happens to be a very, very important day for us at Radio Sai, because
yes,
it's the day on which Swami actually walked into this very flow where we are talking from. Swami spent 1 year. So probably we'll do something different. So dear listeners, it's also a heads up to you. As we are celebrating our anniversary, if there are any thoughts that you would like to share with us, any particular questions that you would like to ask us, we'll be very, very happy to receive them. We would be even very happy to read them out as part of the programs. Probably not only as afternoon satsang, even the other programs. So if you have any of your thoughts to share with us about what you think about this beautiful gift that Swami has given all of us, not just you listeners, even for all of us, to be a part of Radio Sai is really a gift. And we would love to hear from you, your thoughts. And we will definitely come back next week as part of afternoon satsang, but probably share something different from, we'll take a break from the conversations and do something different.
Definitely. I don't know how it just slipped my mind. Thanks, Prem, for adding that. So on that note, dear listeners, we offer this segment again at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan. Grateful to him. And we'll end with this song. And on the other side of it, you can listen to the segment Love to Love.
Jati re, माझी बहीण चंद्रभागा, माझी बहीण चंद्रभागा।
जय जय राम कृष्ण हरि,
जय जय राम कृष्ण हरि,
जय जय